On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The judge handling the case was a lady. She's passed away since. But when I got up there, to take me up to the courtroom, there were all kinds of LAPD brass. There was a commander by the name of Stuart Maislin, who was the risk prevention officer in charge. There was a deputy chief. They were watching this thing like a hawk. And they said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Federal marshal showed up at my house." And so then I got called into the chambers by this judge. And I said, "Your Honor, I know stuff I've never revealed about this case." And she says, "What?" I said, "I met some white men." She says, "I have a sense that there's missing information. There's a gap." And I said, "Yes, there is." And I said, "I know exactly where these files are hidden." And she said, "Where?" And I told her. I told her the filing cabinet behind this particular officer's desk. And he has a hidden compartment in his desk in robbery and homicide.
The Biggie Forgotten Files could be its own standalone podcast. And the document that defines the information and narrative was filed on July 7th of 2005 in the United States District Court for the Central District of California. Again, this legal filing is still under a federal protective order. I shouldn't have this document, but I do, and now I can share the exact information and narrative on what the forgotten files actually are. In June of 2005, the Wallace family civil trial was in court. The wheels of justice were spinning. On a Friday afternoon, Perry Sanders told the court and the judge that he had received a telephone call from someone claiming to be a former officer of the LAPD. This person in the phone call provided detailed information about the existence of evidence concerning the Biggie murder. The judge directed the Wallace family lawyers to provide to the city of LA all available information about this development and directed the city of LA to conduct a thorough investigation. The trial was temporarily adjourned.
The civil trial brought by the Wallace family against the city exposed evidence the LAPD failed to produce that suggests two rogue police officers, David Mack and Rafael Perez, while not fitting the description of the gunman, may have been involved in the murder of the rapper also known as Biggie Smalls. This potentially explosive evidence involves an alleged conversation between former LAPD officer Rafael Perez and Perez's cellmate in the LA County Jail. According to this court record revealed now for the first time, Perez's cellmate told investigators, "Perez and Mack were involved in Death Row Records. Perez got involved in Death Row through Mack. They went to all their parties and stuff," the inmate testified. "But there's more." The inmate also told investigators Perez told him he was at the scene of the notorious BIG murder. Perez was working security. Perez had a cell phone. Perez said he called over to Mack, David Mack, on his cell phone. Perez told Mack that Biggie Smalls was in his truck. Perez never said that he set up Biggie Smalls, but I have heard that he had something to do with that murder. This is just a glimpse into hundreds of pages of documents involving this inmate's sworn statements that were not turned over to Wallace family attorneys, former LAPD lead investigator Russell Poole.
Those documents are crucial.
That weekend, the lawyers for the City of LA and the Los Angeles Police Department conducted a physical search of the offices of the infamous LAPD Robbery Homicide Division.
I walk into this room, Don, and there's like 10 of these robbery homicide guys. the most hardcore, old school, grumpy, whatever you want. And basically, they're the robbery homicide people. That's like the creme de la creme of the detectives there. I mean, it's a big deal to be part of that. And the fact that you've got this 3-year FBI agent that's coming in there and sitting down with these guys and telling them, hey, this is the case I've got going on. The reason that we opened it up, and I kind of gave them a little bit of the background, and they already knew that I had been part of Rampart. They knew from all the publicity that I was the case agent on the Palmeros case, and it just pissed them off. And the fact that I was investigating and actually had successfully prosecuted some of these LAPD officers, some of their own, that just doesn't sit well with these guys. So, I mean, I don't want to say they felt threatened by me, but they were without a doubt threatened by me. And especially since I was such a young guy. These robbery homicide guys, Don, I mean, they're all guys that got like 15, 20 plus years on the job.
As a result of the search of robbery homicide, undisclosed evidence was discovered, much of which was in the desk or cabinet of Detective Stephen Katz, the lead detective in the Biggie murder investigation. The documents centered around interviews by numerous police officers of an incarcerated informant who had been Rafael Perez's cellmate for some extended period of time. Now, from season one of the dossier, we understand this informant to be Kenneth Boagne. Boagne told LAPD investigators that Perez told him about his and Mac's involvement with Death Row Records and their activities at the Peterson Automotive Museum the night of Biggie's murder. Monday morning, after the search of robbery homicide, the documents were handed over to the Wallace family. So let's just stop for a second and go back to the idea of discovery and legal terms and what litigation abuse is, and what the city of LA did was blatantly illegal and not just or moral. The judge gave Perry Sanders and the team additional time to review these materials and to also do depositions. When the trial resumed on July 5th of 2005, Perry Sanders and the legal team for the Wallace family asked the court for an entry of default against the city of LA or to declare a mistrial.
Judge sanctioned them, and we were getting ready to go crush them, and then they got this investigative privilege invoked. That was the last ruling of the court, so it's the ruling in the case. So they still have, and guess what? What we now know is, and so what they started doing was giving Judge Cooper things that if they were related to my case, they had to give me. But guess what they started giving her? The Greg Kading bullshit.
Yeah, man.
You follow what I'm saying? It was it was one of the most comprehensive orchestrated gags I've ever seen or heard of in my life. Well, now we know Kading being the person that he is, who I personally think Chuck Phillips wrote the freaking book. That's the, you want to, this is my theory. He either wrote the book or came close to writing the book. This is the biggest protection deal that's ever gone on. One of the biggest in history.
Detective Steve Katz was deposed in the civil trial 3 times. In August of 2003, he testified that the file provided to the Wallace family contained all the information developed by the Los Angeles Police Department concerning the case. That seems laughable looking back now, and I'll have to research what happens when an officer of the law lies under oath. Are there any penalties at all? At the time of the deposition, Katz knew he had volumes of material in his locked cabinet. When asked by the Wallace family about the information on Rafael Perez and David Mack inside these files, Katz said no such information existed. In fact, the following list of items, which all were subject to discovery, were a part of the Biggie Forgotten files. Here is a list. And with some of these files, I will give you my own speculation as to what they pertain to or why they were important in the murder of Biggie. Here they are as listed in the legal filing. tape recordings of interviews by the LAPD with Kenneth Boagne.
Well, Steve Taft wants to know about everything about Notorious B.I.G., the plotting they paid. They didn't come just see me once. They came and saw me three times, you know. So that's when I knew that whatever I'm telling them is something has to be checking out for them to come back and ask me more questions two more times. But then, from my understanding, it went all the way up to the chief of police. So they knew who I was. I mean, it wasn't no secret. I mean, they knew who I was. They just didn't want to admit that some of their guys was involved with. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't pull the trigger, but they were neck deep in it. You know what I'm saying?
Transcripts also existed of Board of Rights testimony by Kenneth Boagne. There's a Teams report regarding David Mack. Now, this file is interesting and would tell a lot. A Teams report was designed to identify police officers at risk of engaging in future problematic behavior. According to the documents, the Teams report was missing from Mack's personnel file. This file would provide a chronology of all personnel complaint investigation in Mack's career. When the files were turned over, it was missing 15 such investigations in said file.
Several LAPD officers, including Rafael Perez, Nito Durden, and David Mack, were at Fritz's in Bellflower, which is a gentleman's club, a topless bar. And at that meeting was also a gentleman, a rapper, Suge Knight, and some of his other associates and everything. And there was, in a nutshell, there was a hit taken out on Notorious B.I.G.
In a civil trial, no matter if the information is credible or if the information is not credible, it would never justify failing to disclose the evidence to the plaintiffs. A party's obligation in responding to discovery is not to pick and choose which items of evidence it believes will be most valuable to the opposing side. Also listed in the forgotten file is the notes of LAPD detective Cliff Armas. I know through my sources that Cliff was a good guy. He was trying to do the right thing inside his investigation into not only Rampart, but the Biggie stuff. If that is the case, then it makes more sense that some of his worked product would have been locked away in the desk. Here is the list of that material. Detective Armas's notes on 11/13/2000, which is an interview of Kenneth Boagne, an employee report made after the 11/13 interview, documentation of a police interview of the inmate on 12/10/2000, and a summary of a 12/19/2000 interview of Boagne. So, reading through the tea leaves here, Cliff Armas interviewed Kenneth Boagne not once, but three times. I would imagine that speaks to his credibility. If you went to a prison and interviewed Kenny Boagne that many times and documented it. Continuing on, there's an employee report made after the 12/19 interview. And on 1/14/01, there's an employee report to someone named Weber, a name I've not heard before. On 4/3/01, Armas wrote in his own employee report on the Biggie Smalls murder transcripts of three additional Board of Rights hearings. And on 4/6/2001, there's another report of Boagne. So that now is four interviews that Armas conducted in the span of a year. Last but not least, there is a document of Steve Katz's own chronology of his trips to interview Kenneth Boagne and handwritten statements by Boagne.
If your sergeant or your lieutenant said, hey, I'm going to beef you, I'm going to file a complaint against you, a discipline complaint, you would call Officer Rep Section and say, hey, I'm getting beefed, I need some representation. And they would assign a guy like Cliff Armas. Cliff would be like your representative. He would, if you hired lawyers, whatever, he would be there with you, and he would make sure that whatever internal documents your lawyer needed, he would get access to. And they were given the power internally to have access to whatever if it involved a discipline case.
As is stated in the legal filings, the sheer volume of information attests to the seriousness with which the defendant treated this information. If the LAPD or the city didn't find Kenneth Boagne credible, why did they question him on at least four occasions? If you add the trips that city attorney Don Vincent took to visit Boagne in jail, this is very telling. All right, so life doesn't happen bi-weekly, so why should payday? The money you earn can be in your hands today with EarnIn. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the EarnIn app and verify your paycheck. Then access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. So maybe you need to get your kids something special, or you and the wife need a scintillating night out every once in a while, at least. So download EarnIn today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in the dossier under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. The Wallace family lawyers argued in court that they started the civil trial with two arms tied behind their backs. It's an understatement. They made opening statements and questioned numerous witnesses before a jury, ignorant of the considerable volume of potential evidence being secreted in a detective's desk drawer. Detective Steve Katz, acting alone or in concert with others, made a decision to conceal from the Wallace family lawyers information which could have supported their contention that David Mack was responsible for the Wallace murder. With Kenneth Boagne being such a huge part of the Forgotten Files, I thought it was important to speak to him about some of the items mentioned above. I'm also happy to report that he's been released from jail and now is a free man. We spoke over the phone while he was still incarcerated, and Kenneth gave me a little more background on his interactions with investigators that included Steve Katz and Cliff Armis. He also provided me with some new information that relates to the Biggie murder. Here's Kenneth Boagne.
So after he decides to talk and he tells you all of this stuff, at what point how does it go from you two are in a prison, he tells you something, how does it turn that people are now coming to try and talk to you? Or do you reach out to people? And if you reach out to people, who do you go and talk to?
I didn't reach out to anyone. I get my sentence 40 to life. I'm in Calipatria State Prison on a mainline 4-yard maximum security prison. A guy just got killed. Just got his whole neck chopped off. Got his whole ring in me. The neck tied him like five people in front of me. A Crip out of L.A. That was in November. Cliff Armis and them came. Cliff Armis and them showed up at the prison. Cliff Armis,
so Cliff,
and Lori Gillian.
Cliff Armis shows up at the prison.
Calipatria State Prison.
He's the first,
the first person
to show up. What does Cliff Armis say to you, and who does he say he's working for? Talk me through that.
He told me, he said, he's here, and with the hope that I can help him out and get some clarity about me and Perez's relationship. Evidently, he had talked to a sheriff deputy named Claudia Rodas that said me and Perez were tight. And she sent them to me. She sent Cliff and them to talk to me. She had talked to Cliff, Armis, or whoever else she talked to, and Cliff came and found me. I had no idea. I didn't even know who Cliff Armis was. I wasn't even thinking about Perez and all the stuff he told me. It was the last thing on my mind. I thought it was, they said I had an attorney visit. I thought it was for my appeal. I go out there. First thing I see is the holster on his side. Not the gun in it, just the holster. I said, oh, this is police. You know, now I'm worried. You know, what the hell are the police doing up here? You know, you got the guys working in the visiting room. They see the holster, so they know it's police, you know, and that's never good. You know, when the police is coming to visit you. So Cliff asked me, he said, I'm here. I need to know about you and Perez's relationship. I said, we was all right. You know, what's going on? He said, do you know of a sergeant? Do you know Sergeant Burns? I said, I know of a Sergeant Burns. He was like, well, what do you know of Sergeant Burns? I said, you're talking about the sergeant that Perez lied about as far as saying about the steps and the beer and all that stuff. So he immediately told me to stop talking, and he turned the mic on. He turned the recorder on. And I said, man, I'm not going to let you record me. You know? I said, you can turn that off. So he turned it off, and I told him everything I knew about Perez and the Sergeant Burns case. He told me he was here, he was investigating, but claimed that Perez said the sergeant knew that they had beat this guy up really bad, you know what I'm saying? And I remember that case specifically, because Perez had a phone.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And he would take cases out of the folder and go over those cases. That's the case that he was going to be talking about in his debriefings or when they would come see him. They would come see him a lot.
When Cliff Armis came to see you, how long had you been in the same jail as Perez?
I had been, well, I was out of the jail with Perez. I was no longer in, I had left Perez.
Okay.
I had left Perez. I had transferred. I was in the county jail with Perez. I went to prison. I was now in maximum security prison. You know, it's not a soft prison. I was in Calipatra State Prison. I was in state prison. And me and Perez was in the county jail together.
Okay, and so you were in the county jail with Perez for how long?
Yeah. I was in the county jail from November 11th till July 6th.
And I'm assuming you're in some sort of, like, protective unit because your family is
Absolutely.
Law enforcement, correct?
Yeah. Yes, my brother and them did me a favor to send me there.
So one of the deputies in the county jail must have talked to Armis somehow?
Yes, Claudia Rodas. It came out later on that Claudia Rodas talked to Cliff Armis, and that's how they knew about me and Perez's relationship being tight. So they picked me up that morning, which I think would be Tuesday morning, December 12th, and they taken to the Bradbury building, and during the hearing, one of the lawyers for Cullen Patel asked, did Perez ever mention about Death Row Records? Him working
Who?
For Death Row Records. And they,
Who asked you?
A lawyer for Cullen Patel. I think his last name was Seaman.
And who did he work for?
He worked for the, He was Cullen Patera's lawyer, so he was with the Office of Representation section. You know how when an officer gets in trouble, they get him a lawyer?
Yeah. So he asked you if Perez ever worked for Death Row.
Yeah.
And did you answer?
They shut the hearing down. They told me not to answer. That's when Hermosillo, is that his name?
Yeah.
Hermosillo was there that day, and that's when they shut the hearing down. And told me not to answer that question, that was still under some type of investigation, and told me not to answer no questions about Death Row Records. And they closed the hearing, made everybody leave out.
Okay.
You know, and it was kind of wild.
This was about, Sergeant Patel?
No, this is just a regular officer.
Okay.
Yeah, Perez got caught in a lie about him being at a crash pad, you know, at a party. At some party they were having at a crash pad with dead brought women. You know, they had a little apartment building that they would set up in.
Yeah.
To watch gang members in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And they were having a party there. They had like a little get-together party where people in the loop came, and Cutty Patel was in the loop. I remember Perez specifically telling me Cutty Patel was in the loop, but he was trying to get all the officers he could investigated. So he said that Cutty Patel was there. And Cutty Patel wasn't there. He was at Disneyland with his family.
Okay.
You know, and Perez did not like that, man. So he vowed to get Cutty Patel. He vowed to get him. He wanted every case he came on, every case he came under, Perez was trying to make bad. You know, every case Cutty Patel was involved in, Perez was trying to make it seem like Cutty Patel did something wrong.
Yeah.
You know. So I testified to that fact, that he was out to get Cutty Patel and a few other officers. But a lot of them officers, you know, a couple of officers that, you know, maybe seven or eight officers he lied on, but some of them was just crooked as hell. You know what I'm saying? And when the administration asked me, well, why didn't you tell us about who was bad? I said, well, you guys never came and asked me anything. You know what I'm saying? And I remember it was a tall sergeant there, if I'm not mistaken. His name was, that could have been at the county jail when a captain or assistant police chief Paysinger was there. I mean, you know, I remember him coming up to me and telling me, thank you. You know, and told the administration, this guy has a lot of information. You guys might want to talk to him, but they never came and talked to him. You know.
When does the actors, I'll call them actors because it's Perry Sanders, Dennis Chang, when does all this civil stuff start? Is it after Rampart?
It was way after Rampart. It was in 2002 now, I was in Calipatra. Again, I ended up going back to Calipatra on the SNY side, which is a sensitive knee yard, because I couldn't go back on the main line anymore for my name being in the paper. So they got me SNY over the phone. I didn't even have to go back to Calipatra. I went to Corcoran, and from Corcoran, I went to Lancaster. And then from Lancaster, I went to Calipatra. I was in Calipatra, and I'm reading the Vibe magazine, and I see that they have, I'd already told Cliff about Perez and them involved in the homicide, and later on they had sent the homicide detectives to talk to me. Cliff was the first one I told.
So you told Cliff about,
yeah,
which homicide?
About the Notorious B.I.G. and the part Biggie and Mac and them played in.
But when did you tell Cliff? Because remember before when we were talking, you said,
yeah, I didn't tell Cliff. Cliff, we were driving back from at board hearing, and I was I had to be in Lancaster.
Uh-huh.
We were driving back from Lancaster, and I said, hey, Cliff. No, I was in Sat F. I said, hey, Cliff, you know, Perez and him was involved in a B.I.G. murder. And he was driving me back from my administrative board here. They came and got me early in the morning from Saturday. And we were
and what did, what did
back.
Cliff say?
He said, man, and that's when I told him, I said, he was, why don't you check out and see if he signed his name on the log about going to see the B.I.G.'s body whenever it was in the morgue. So he came back maybe about a week later and said, hey, man, you were correct. He did sign in on the morgue. I can't believe he told you that. He said, do you want me to send the homicide detectives to you? I said, no, I'm not ready to do that yet. Because, you know, I wasn't, you know, that's how I take poker right there. You know, when you start, you know, talking about, you know, testifying for homicides and stuff like that. So I said, no, I don't think I'm ready for that yet. So, about maybe 5 or 6 months later, almost maybe 6 months later, I called Cliff. I said, hey, man, you know, I think I'm ready, man. You can send these people down. So they came down. Cat, Adrian Soler, and Robert Bubb.
Why did he say, you know, he went to the morgue? Why would he go to the morgue?
He just wants to see the body. I guess he wants to see the body. But Cliff Armis told me that he actually did sign in. This was before that
Perez signed it. That Perez signed it. And Cliff Armas found it out.
Cliff Armas. Yeah, I told him before I even talked to homicide detectives. I told Cliff to go check this out because I don't want to seem like a fool. You know what I'm saying? Cliff Armas wouldn't check it out. That's when he contacted the homicide detectives and he told them. You know, but when I told them, when they came back the next time, they said there's no record of him.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I knew then they weren't being honest because Cliff had already told me that he had signed in. And what I told him, I checked out. Katz, Adrian Soler, and Robert Burrow.
These were all homicide guys.
Yeah, they were homicide. They came to give him all the information. I tell them everything. Off camera. Off tape, I tell them everything.
Yep.
They said, look, man, if your story check out, we're going to come back and see you. About maybe 3 weeks later, they came back and saw me. And I said, they wanted me to go on tape and all that. So I'm not going on tape. I don't feel comfortable going on tape, man. They said, well, will you testify? I said, well, I'm not sure about testifying no homicide. They was like, well, look, don't talk to anybody. Don't discuss this with anybody. Until you hear from us. They made it perfectly clear. Don't talk to nobody. Don't talk to nobody or nothing. So, I called them. I was calling them, seeing what was going on. They told me they were going to get back with me. They came back and said, look, Bogan, we got to get the FBI taking over the case. They were just lying to me. We got to get the murder books and all this shit. Some shit I didn't understand. They were like, look, call us in the a couple of months, we'll tell you what's going on. So I'm calling them. They're never answering the phone. I'm calling them. And all of a sudden, they don't accept collect calls no more.
When Perez tells you, he then tells you about the money aspect of it, right? That what does he tell you about who was paid or not paid? What was that in regards to?
This was it. They had gave Muhammad some money up front. I'm not sure how much. I think $200,000 from Suge. From supposed to be Suge. They never mentioned Suge's name. I gotta say that. They never mentioned his name. They called him the boss. They never mentioned his name. They had been stalking Biggie and his whole crew. They had been watching him and stalking and stuff like that. I say stalking, but that's not his word. Those are mine. I say stalking because when you watch somebody and kill him, I think he's stalking. I think he made him pray. That's just me.
And he said prior to that night had been following Biggie and seeing where he was going.
Yeah, he said at some Death Row security meetings that they had met with Reggie White and Dave Kenner. Dave Kenner gave a message to Reggie White for Mac specifically to take care of something. He didn't say what he said to take care of. Find somebody to take care of everything. So, evidently, they found Muhammad. And then with Muhammad, talked to Muhammad, Mac and Perez talked to Muhammad. Then he told me, a couple of days went by, they were at Death Row Security Office, and Mac and Reggie White was just on fire. I mean, they were mad as hell. They were, you know, they were just upset. And then when Gaines came to the meeting, Mac attacked them. You know, and Gaines was like, you know, what's the hell wrong with you know, they was like, what's going on with you, man? You know, what's happening with you? Gaines like, man, you didn't do what you were supposed to do. Gaines was supposed to cut off Puff Daddy and Biggie at the same, you know, cut off both cars. And then I guess the shooter was supposed to take care of his business Biggie's killing took place. Evidently, the boss, who I believe was Suge reneged. He said, I ain't paying shit. You know, he was in jail. I ain't paying this shit. You know, so this dude, Amir Muhammad, told Mac and Perez straight up, man, Suge didn't contact me to do nothing. Y'all did. When they told him that he wasn't paying. He was like, I want my money. You know what I'm saying? I guess we're going to get with them.
So after he tells you this, he then proceeds, he talks about the bank robbery?
Yeah, he talks about the bank robbery. He talks about his how he went to his job first, to the station, made a big scene. He made a big scene that day, so everybody can know he was there. He raced back to where wherever this bank was. I have no idea where the bank was or nothing. He was just Mac and some other guys went in there. Mac, it was Mac's girlfriend. He never told me it was Mac's girlfriend. I found out later that it was Mac's girlfriend. Mac and them went and did the robbery with guns and everything, got in the car, and they all dispersed. Now, they met Muhammad in Vegas and paid him the rest of the money. You know, they gave him, I think they gave him maybe 400 grand of the money. They told him that's all they had was 400 grand. You know, and they were prepared. It was Sammy Martin Perez, Mac, and one other guy. Some friend of Mac that was not even a part of the department that was involved in the bank robbery. Sammy Martin, Perez, and David Mack went to Vegas to pay off Muhammad. They met at some strip club, I remember him telling me. And, you know, these are the kind of stories that you won't forget. You know, people tell stories in prison all the time. People tell stories in jail. But when you get stories like this, these are stories that you don't kind of forget.